He is indeed the founder. The founder and director of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C. One of my students presently spending time as an intern in Washington called me up one day and said to the police war, this guy Gaffney is coming out of my ears and eyes. In other words, he's a consultant and one of those many defense specialists who Shona, they redid some of them with advice on the progress of the Iraq-Allied war. Frank Gaffney, let me just say from a media guide, which was published a few weeks ago, it simply says, a former Reagan Defense Department official and director of the Center for Security Policy in Washington appears in various publications, most frequently as a contributor to Defense News. Where other commentators were episodic with sanguine observations on the end of the Cold War, and now I give away your secret, Gaffney was the gadfly all over. And all year. Sober, reflective, he didn't let anything on the scene pass without careful scrutiny. He's known for his sharp attacks on virtually everybody in Washington. He had his career, a distinguished career in the Defense Department between 83 and 1987, where he was Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Nuclear Policy and Arms Control Policy, under with Richard Perle. In shorthand, he worked for the Prince of Darkness.
Yeah.
In 1987, after Richard Perle's resignation from his position, Mr. Gaffney was nominated to fill the slot and asked the president later on to withdraw the nomination for various reasons. Mr. Gaffney. Size and all of his degrees, but all of this pales as against the other one.
Thank you very much, Jim. It is usually extremely unpleasant to find myself in my present position, which is to say, following the presentations or speeches or interventions of two of the most eloquent, thoughtful, and distinguished observers of the scene of our time. And Sheldon, I'm sorry, but the two I had in mind were Bill Buckley and my friend Alan Keyes. In this case, I will tell you I'm not too unhappy, because I think they have both very helpfully contributed to the point that I wanted to make in the context of a discussion about the Cold War. Alan has, as you've just heard, with characteristic incisiveness, pointed out that what we're not talking about is the question of whether anybody, any serious person, actually thinks there's still a competition free market, democratic principles, and command economic, communist ideology. And I think Bill Buckley very helpfully pointed out something that I certainly believe, which is that wars can be declared over and not necessarily be over. And I would like to just point out a few, I think, rather interesting parallels between the war that Bill and I agree is not yet over in Iraq, and a war that is not simply an ideological contest, but, as Alan has said, a geostrategic contest, continues apace between and a fundamentally unreformed, if failing, Soviet Union, and this country and the West as a whole. The first parallel I will suggest is, as I've just mentioned, the very fact that we are in the position of having declared victories in both of these contests without having ensured that the enemy's power is in fact broken. I think it's sort of ironic that as President Bush was trumpeting the victory over this Vietnam syndrome, it seemed to me at least that he was falling prey to its continuing effect. In obliging the U.S. military to pull its punches to stop short of accomplishing the mission, which I felt throughout the crisis was the end of Saddam Hussein's reign of terror, he effected essentially the same inevitable result as when Lyndon Johnson and other American politicians told the military not to fight the war militarily efficaciously against Vietnam. In so doing, I regret to say, we see a parallel to the kind of ignoring of the actual threat that continues to be posed by the Soviet Union. A military threat that, interestingly, I was doing something with CNN yesterday in which I simply could not fit into a soundbite the proposition that the interviewer wanted me to address, namely, now that the Soviet threat is gone, why do we still need SDI? When I had to start with the proposition that Soviet missiles capable of attacking the United States are not only every bit as ready and as dangerous as they were at the darkest days of the Cold War, but are actually more dangerous, more capable than they were earlier on. Indeed, the Army, which we've talked about a little bit this morning, demoralized though it may be, relocated though it may be, retains essentially all of the equipment that it has had at its disposal during the dark days of the Cold War. And I think, notwithstanding this glorious new conventional forces in Europe agreement, which permits them to retain all of this equipment, we will see the Soviet Union retaining the capability to reconstitute a threat to Europe far faster than we will be able to prevent that threat from materializing. And of course, the military-industrial base in the Soviet Union remains as vigorous as ever. Some estimates, I think including the Committee on the Present Danger, which has just published a very impressive study of Soviet military activities, suggest that perhaps as much as 30 or even 50% of the declining Soviet GNP is now still being squandered on military production and related development and other activities. A second interesting parallel in my mind is that the United States is clearly making common cause with both of those powers that it is nominally defeated. In the case of Iraq, of course, we've allowed Saddam Hussein to continue to use his helicopters, his tanks, his artillery pieces, his secret police, his Republican Guard, in Brunei, to preserve his regime and ruthlessly to suppress his adversaries. In the Soviet Union, we have offered remarkable political support, including summits and the stiff arming of the democratic opposition. Economic and financial concessions, like $1.3 billion 4 months ago and perhaps as much as $1.5 billion next month. Militarily relevant strategic technologies of the kind that we woke up with a start to discover were in Saddam Hussein's hands, only worse. And of course, flawed arms control pacts, like the CFE treaty, with significant verification problems and other defects. A third parallel is that we have wound up placing priority on preserving the territorial integrity of nations like the Soviet Union and Iraq, even as they have been defeated by us. We've heard Dick Pipes, among others, mention the curious phenomenon of opposing the empires of our allies and favoring the preservation of the empires of our foes. I think the fact that we are at least as committed to preserving the territorial integrity of Iraq as we are the integrity of the Soviet Union tends to undermine the question of, is this just a reflection of a legitimate concern about nuclear civil wars breaking out in the Soviet Union? In short, to conclude, as I must, I personally believe that this Cold War, as it should be defined, namely a contest between the forces of democracy, freedom, human rights, and economic opportunity, traditionally aligned with the West, and the forces of despotism, disdain and loathing of human rights, and the lack of economic opportunity, typically associated with totalitarian regimes of the left, and for that matter of the right, continues. And as Alan Keyes correctly pointed out, we best keep that in mind as we think about our relations with foreign powers, both great and small.